Video teaching this class, and I always know that the week of Thanksgiving on Tuesday, you know, much lower population than every other class period all year. This is totally predictable. So it's hard to know exactly what to do with this class period. I mean, I'm here, you're here, we're going to damn well have class, the real thing. I'm not going to cancel like some weeny faculty members do. But on the other hand, I know that some people have some maybe legitimate family reasons why they leave early for the holiday. So I'm trying something different this year than I've ever done before on the Tuesday of Thanksgiving week. We're going to have a lecture I've never given before in architecture and society, I'll tell you about it in a minute. But anyway, I'm going to respond to the odd nature of this class. These last three lectures today and the two next week, the last of the semester, are like the first few lectures where we were kind of looking in a broader sense at architecture. They're not going to be as focused on form or physical considerations or human factors. They will be heavily weighted on the final, along with those first three lectures, because the tests tended to deal with those segments of form, physical considerations, and human factors. So a fair amount of the final will be on these last three class periods. So although this one's going to be a standalone, the content of it is not going to be something we're going to be working on again on Tuesday or Thursday. For those of you who show up, hell, I'm going to make it worth your while, because there will definitely be questions on the final, on the material today. So that said, let's go back and talk a little at the beginning here about the Twitter card responses from last Tuesday's class. I could just blow these off because we had a test and you've probably forgotten that lecture anyway. But I thought, you know, these are too good to miss. So I want to read you a few of those. If you'll remember, that lecture was on meaning in architecture. How does architecture communicate something? What are the messages we get from architecture? And I ask you as a Twitter card question, tell me something that might have communicated something to you in terms of architecture you've experienced firsthand. So got some really cool answers. So one person says, all the buildings located in the downtown area of my hometown are very old and lack maintenance. But the city is very scared about messing with it because of how much nostalgia it evokes. Downtown Laredo makes the older, more conservative population indirectly think about the good old days and makes them feel like they belong somewhere in our rapidly changing world. That's pretty damn significant, that it makes people feel like they belong somewhere. I've got roots here in this town. And if that disappears, my roots are gone. Very cool observation. Somebody else says, my sister was in a children's hospital for a couple of weeks. I noticed that the building was decorated and shaped with bright colors and images of cheerful things kids would do outside of the hospital in the real world. The hospital literally conveyed the idea of perseverance and happiness to children. Again, very cool. Somebody else says, the Balloon Museum in Albuquerque, New Mexico has a literal direct communication to its content because it is shaped like a hot air balloon. The Albuquerque International Balloon Fiesta brings hundreds of thousands of visitors every year, and the Balloon Museum captures the event and its importance to the city year-round. Then there is, I always have the TAs harvest the kind of a selection of Twitter card responses, and each TA sends it to me, and then I select out of those. So I usually get about 20 from the TAs, and I select about 6 or 7 to read in class. Out of these 20, there were 3 that were on the same topic. And that doesn't happen very often. But it was, not surprisingly, about football stadiums. What is the meaning of a football stadium? So let me read you three diverse reactions to the meaning of a football stadium. Someone says, I'm from Allen, Texas, where high school football dominates over practically everything else. Our town recently built a new football stadium that clearly depicts the prominence of football in everyday life there. It sits right on a busy street in front of the high school and is massive in size. To me, this suggests that football is more important than education in our town. But here's a slightly different take. The high school in the city I lived in has a massive football stadium. The city has only has two high schools and one varsity football team, but the stadium was the biggest in the area. The city wanted to express how important football was to its residents and also intimidate visiting teams. Then a third football stadium one. Somebody says, coming from a high school with one of the best football teams in Texas, the football stadium was the heart and soul of our town. Every weekend it would be completely filled and it brought together the whole community. It had a sense of pride, family, and tradition associated with it. So it's amazing, and this is perfectly legitimate, that to different people or from different perspectives, that emblem can mean a different thing. But in all three cases, very important emblem in their city. A couple of others, somebody says, the local church in the village I come from is built right in the center of the village, and then the village developed around it. In that way, it conveys the message that it's of central importance to the life of the villagers. It's also surrounded by a big courtyard that gives a place for gathering and meeting to the other villagers. It similarly communicates that it's the center of life for the village. Then finally, my best friend in Houston lives with her Dutch family in a one-story home. They are the warmest, most welcoming people I've ever known, and their home reflects this. They don't have a fence, flowers grow wild on their land at the side of their house, and they're always out on the veranda that wraps around the house. It's a place where all life is free to come and go. So all kinds of buildings, from homes to hot air museums to hospitals to football stadiums, these have a way of saying something about who we are as a culture and who we are as individuals within that. So I said in an early lecture that I'm a total architecture junkie. And I love to read about it, I love to talk about it, I love to go visit it, I love to design it, I love to watch it under construction. I'm a total junkie. And I've been trying all semester to get you hooked as well. So the last 4 days, I took a whirlwind trip to Dubai. I'm just about worn to a frazzle from all the jet lag and back and forth, but just a really quick trip to Dubai for business. But when I was there, of course, I had to go look around in the city and got an opportunity to do that as part of doing my business there. But this is a phenomenal place that 45 years ago was pretty much nothing in Dubai. And in 45 years, they have made themselves a world city. So they now are hosting Expo 2020, which is the world exposition that happens every 5 years. And in 2020, it'll go to Dubai, a city that 50 years before was nothing, didn't exist. And now they're up with Barcelona and London and New York and Paris and all these other cities that have hosted world expositions in a very short period of time. Now, how the hell did they do that? And I think they would say immediately that a whole lot of it was they used architecture as their way to gain a prominence on the world stage. They built the Burj Khalifa, which you can like it or hate it, but it was the tallest building in the world at the time, and it became this huge emblem. In fact, probably most of you have some kind of sense of what the Burj Khalifa looks like. And that became an emblem for Dubai, and it began to give them meaning. It gave them something people could identify with that city. The building of the Burj Khalifa, if there were nothing inside that building, if it were just a big stage set, it would probably have been worth the investment for giving a presence to that city. And that's the power of just this one architectural object. So, you know, as I travel around and I look at these places and as I experience them, I love going to old buildings, and that's great. I gotta say, I'm still just hooked on Gothic cathedrals and Renaissance palazzos and, just going to those warms my heart, gives me goosebumps. Walking into a Gothic cathedral and hearing the organist practicing for the service on Sunday, and the sound of that music in those amazing spaces, it's just blows you away. Years and years ago, when I was in my 20s, I saw the Taj Mahal. And that was a building that I'd seen photographs of thousands of times. Everybody knows what the Taj Mahal looks like. But I will tell you, when I got there, I was just blown away. Oh my God, it is so astounding in just every way possible. And then, 30 years later, I went back there again and thought, I know this building. I've been here before. I know what I'm about to experience. But then all over again, it just blew me away. It was so freaking beautiful. And so I love these old traditional buildings. But that's not for me the best of what architecture is. It's not what I like the most. It's great, but it's not the best thing architecture does. And I also love just badass brand new buildings. Oh my God, just knock you on your ass and some new, fresh, crazy thing somebody's done. A couple of weekends ago, I went with my brother to Los Angeles and saw the new Broad Museum. This is the hottest, newest thing in the last few months, and I want to see it. I couldn't wait to see it. And it is just amazing gallery spaces. Beautiful, beautiful light, and art just sings in those spaces. It's the thrill, and it's right next to the Disney Concert Hall, so I had to go back and revisit an old friend there. My brother had not been there, so we did the whole Disney Concert Hall thing again and saw a few other cool new buildings in Los Angeles. Los Angeles always got something new going on. And that's thrilling, and I love that. And I'm hooked on trying to, experience these things firsthand, these new, interesting buildings. But again, I would not say that's the best thing about architecture for me. That's not the part I like the most. In my book, the best thing about architecture is seeing architecture that makes people's lives better. And that's often, it's just everyday buildings. It's schools, and it's churches, and it's hospitals, and it's housing, and it's office spaces, and those things that just contribute to people's everyday life. And that's the sort of thing that you see when you, I'm going out to dinner tonight. I'm going to a restaurant I haven't been at. I hear that it's just an amazing, interesting space on the inside. That's everyday life. That just makes my life better. If I've got a really pleasant place to be with my son and his wife who are coming in for Thanksgiving, and that's what architecture is there for. It's to make your everyday life better. And all of you will be probably, many of you going home for a family Thanksgiving. And I can remember the first house I ever designed from scratch for a young family in Burnett, Texas, out on a ranch. And on Thanksgiving Day, after the house was finished, the dad in that family called me up about 6 o'clock in the evening and said, "We had our Thanksgiving dinner in the house that, we've all been working on, you designed for us. And it was the best Thanksgiving we've ever had in our family. And it was because the house was so great. It accommodated the whole big family. The dining room was wonderful. We could see the view out to the ranch. Afterwards, everybody spilled out onto the porch and back into the back courtyard, and all the kids could play outside, and you could watch them from the inside, and it was just, everything just worked so great for our Thanksgiving. It just made their life better. It made their holiday better. And that's the power of architecture, to do something as simple as that. And honestly, for me, that's the most important thing that architecture does. It's not the Gothic cathedral that attracts visitors from all over the world, and they go in and they stand in there for 30 minutes or an hour, and they say, holy shit, this is amazing, and then they go back to their everyday life. Or it's not the badass museum building that, you know, people stand in line and, you know, have to get tickets away in advance, and you get in and you say, wow, this kind of blows me away. But then you do that for an hour and you go back to your everyday life, and your everyday life is 99.9999% of what you do, and those momentary experiences are, they're cool, but they're small. And the really incredible thing about architecture is the way it works on everybody's life every day. So in this class, I have never, I've always actually worked hard not to show the work I do as an architect, because I'm a freaking architect. I make the stuff. You know, I'm not just, you know, looking at it. And it's great. It's fun to make the stuff. But generally, I don't want to, I'm not selling any particular point of view on architecture. I don't want you necessarily to have the values I have about architecture or see architecture through my lens. So I show you a ton of buildings that maybe I'm not all that crazy about, but somebody else is crazy about them, and I want, it's a big diverse class. I want you to be exposed to a wide, wide range of buildings and not, and you know, I encourage you in the Twitter card questions, you know, if we're asking about sustainability, I'm fine with you saying, holy shit, I'm gonna buy a big badass house and air condition the hell out of it, because that's who I am. Okay, I get it. That's not my values, that's not my point of view, but you know, I'm just interested in bringing up the topic for you to think about it. And the same way with the Twitter card question about what percentage form, what percentage physical consideration, what percentage human factors, what are your priorities? You know, I've got my own take on that, but you know, I'm fine with someone who looks at one as way more favorable than the others or sees it in a different way than I do. So I don't want to prejudice your own point of view about architecture. Well, maybe I want to prejudice it a little bit, but I'm not looking to tell you what you should think about architecture. So generally, I don't like to show my own work because that makes it out that, you know, this is the right stuff or something. I'm not saying it's the right stuff. It's a way of looking at architecture. But often there's students in the class who say, you know, on course evaluations, which, by the way, they're up on the online now, and I really appreciate it if you fill out your course evaluation. I especially appreciate it if you make a comment or two. Tell me what's good, what's not good about the class, because I'll definitely read them all and learn from them. But there are people who do say on those course evaluations, why don't you show your own work? I want to know what you think, what you do. Just curiosity. So this year, this semester for the first time, this session we're going to talk about my work, okay? I'm going to sort of force it down your throat. But, you know, and I'm not pushing it as the right way or a good way even. I'm just saying this is my perspective on architecture, and it's partly because I do believe in architecture that makes lives better. And in what I think we're trying to do in my firm is in every kind of building to try to make physical environments that support and advance people's own lives. And that means that, you know, we have done museums, but that's not my favorite thing to do. We have done performance halls, but that's nice to do occasionally. But What I really love doing is the buildings that people just use every day, those airports and convention centers and housing and office buildings and things that are parts of people's everyday life. And if we can make those better collectively, oh my God, that makes a difference in the world. So I'm going to run through a few projects, and they're not, I just picked a few that represented various different building types. They're not necessarily my favorite projects we've ever done, or even the most recent, but just a selection of projects. So we're going to start with places where people work. And I think places where people work are phenomenally important. You spend 8 or more hours a day in this space, and I swear this is one of those things where the unconscious experience of architecture becomes extremely important. But if you work in a hellacious work environment, your life will be miserable. Spending 8 hours a day in a cube under fluorescent light in an anonymous environment is mind-dulling. It makes you feel like a drone. It affects your image of yourself. It affects your productivity. I think workplaces are phenomenally important, and they're an incredible tool that can be used to make people more productive, to make companies more profitable, to make people's lives better in those places. So I'm going to give you two examples here. And one of the advantages of showing my own work is because I know it much better. I know those clients. I know how it's performed over time. I can tell you more facts about these. So this is a very quirky work environment that is for a firm called WJE, Wyss Jenner Elsner. They're engineers, and they're very, very smart, very, very top-notch engineers. To do forensic engineering, you have to really know your stuff. And these guys, it's a national firm. They have one of their largest offices in Austin. This particular branch of WJE, they're experts in concrete, and they have a concrete lab in the building, and these guys are just all over concrete. They do consulting on concrete all over the world. They're renowned experts in concrete, and they're really, really into concrete. These guys, man, they can talk concrete. So they had this funky little piece of land they bought out in Loop Land in Austin, not my favorite part of the city, but the particular little piece of land they bought was just big enough for their office building and little parking lot, but in the back it opened onto some land that is owned by the state and will probably never be developed. Essentially a preserve that's in the back there. So part of this is understanding who these people are. These guys, you know, they drive pickup trucks. They're very physical. They're not guys who sit behind a computer screen all day. They work in their lab. They test things. They go out on the job site. They're kind of rough and ready guys, and they love being outdoors. So we tried to connect their workspace with the outdoors and with this view in the back to this preserve area, which they hadn't really thought about that much. They just bought this piece of land because it was the right size. But when we said, oh man, this is a resource, you can really take advantage of this beautiful view out to the hill country beyond. So we gave them outdoor decks and their break room and other conference rooms and so on. They spill out into that backyard and then out to this view to the nature preserve beyond. And this is a couple of them in there, you know. This was a Saturday. They're in with their shorts and their bill caps and their, you know, it's a relaxing, you know, really appropriate place to work for them. But like I said, you know, they're all over concrete. It's kind of an industrial facility in that this lab, they're hauling large quantities of building materials in and out, so it's got to feel like it's a concrete place. Now, when you're inside, you're constantly connected to the outdoors. Because they're engineers, we left all the framing, you know, the wood joists that actually are the structure of the building. We left those exposed in many parts of it. And so the building has the concrete, and it has the warmth of the wood, and it has the views to the outside. And, you know, we just exposed that concrete. It is structural concrete. And in fact, it's a very unusual application of concrete, which was innovative, and we did this in partnership with them so that they could analyze its performance as we were going along. So basically, we're making all the walls out of just concrete. In a normal office building of this scale, you probably would have used metal studs, and you'd put the sheathing on the outside for waterproofing, and then you'd put some kind of brick or stone veneer on the outside of that. There'd be all these different layers, interior finishes, exterior finishes, you know, vapor barrier, insulation, you know, and by a lot of different trades. And that's just how we build walls these days. But we said, what if we could just use the concrete to do everything? And we just build 18-inch thick concrete walls with no reinforcing bars. No reinforcing. Very seldom do you use concrete without reinforcing. But if you keep it all in compression, as you well know, it's a fantastic structural material just in compression. So all of the concrete is in compression 100%. There's no reinforcing in it. And by then just using the concrete, it has very high thermal mass. And so the energy performance is much better because we do heat and air condition the building. But here on the inside, once you get those concrete walls to 72 degrees, they just want to stay that way. They just hold that thermal stability on the inside of the building. So you're able to air condition and heat much less because you've got this high thermal mass that's increasing the thermal stability. We embedded little sensors all over that concrete to be able to test its performance over time. They did what's called a WOFI model, this very sophisticated hygrometer model that allows you to see exactly where the dew point would be so that we knew we wouldn't get any condensation on the inside of that single material. We looked at it all times of the year, all seasons of the year, and really designed it for its highest thermal performance. We made little niches on the right in those concrete walls where they could put all their precious little artifacts from these buildings that they performed forensics on. So, yeah, man, that was that badass piece of concrete from that building that fell down, and whatever. All really meaningful to them, but kind of gave it a reverence, gave it a dignity, so that they see what they do as an important thing. That becomes a kind of museum object for them. You know, some of them have hardwall offices, some are in open offices. All of them have really nice views out to the outside. They're in this big, high ceiling space. This had to be done on the same budget as just a normal little brick veneer dumpy office building in Loopland. But instead, this concrete was extremely economical because we made repetitive formwork, because we didn't put any reinforcing bars in it. The labor was much lower than in normal concrete work. So they got a building that felt like it was big and strong and sturdy rather than little frail, you know, blow away office building. We could get a little bit higher ceilings, expose that structure, and still keep it in their very, very limited budget. So that is an example of really trying to make a place that these guys would feel like this is our office building. This is about what we do. And I will tell you, those guys love their office. They are, in fact, one of their other offices in Denver. Most of their offices rent space in some other office building. They were one of the first to build their own office space. And now their Denver office, they want one. And even though they could hire an architect in Denver, and for a small building, that would make a lot more sense, they came back to us and said, would you design our office building in Denver too? And we want one that we're not concrete people. We're something else. So, but we want it to reflect what we do. And then just to, you know, it just is a fun place to work. The connection to the outdoors, the kind of social atmosphere, relationships between people on the inside, the lightness, the airiness, the warmth, all of those things make these people like to go to work because it's a damn fine place to work. And it has said, what I do is important. What I do is relevant and, you know, has given character to the space where I work. Okay, that's one work environment. This is another kind of work environment. This one, again, kind of an interesting and strange work environment. This is a federal courthouse in Alpine, Texas. So it's, you know, in a relatively small town. It serves a huge area of West Texas. It basically is the federal courthouse for a large, large area of West Texas. And they were in a really dumpy, ratty facility before they built a new courthouse. And it was a big thing for them to get the resources, get the money to be able to do this. And I can remember at the last moment, it looked like they were going to lose their priority among federal courthouses. And they just made a plea that we are in such a rotten, crappy place. And it's deterring us from doing the work we do because our building is just not supporting the work we do. So from day one, they were very ambitious about wanting a building that would support the work they did. They had a design competition for it. We won the design competition and then worked very closely with them after that to bring the building to fruition. And one of the things we were very intent on was making a building that said, okay, we're a federal courthouse, so it needs to have a certain level of dignity and importance, but also that we're the federal courthouse for this region of West Texas. And to have some identity that really lets you feel like this is not a generic courthouse that could be in Des Moines. This is a courthouse that could only really be in the Trans-Pecos area of Texas. So this is a gorgeous region with these beautiful mountains all made out of Pecos red sandstone. You can see it in the landscape there. Relatively rural environment around it. The courthouse itself, meant to have that kind of presence and dignity. It's not a big building, but it's meant to have a scale and a kind of dignity to it that makes you feel like this is an important civic building in our community. It also had to have all of these security requirements that any federal courthouse has to have these days. Ever since the Murrah Building bombing in Oklahoma City, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, they're worried about that kind of terrorism and violence that might, and you know, these courthouses, they make some controversial decisions. And sometimes people feel like they got screwed and they get really angry, and sometimes it's violent people, that's why they're in the courthouse to begin with. So they've got to protect themselves against that. So you have to make it pretty fortified. It has to be what's called blast resistant. It's got to be what's called ram resistant so that you can't take a truck and, you know, run it onto the site. It has to be able to withstand a certain amount of blast without causing damage to the people inside. So we don't want to make it look like a freaking prison. So we're trying to make it look civic, but at the same time, fortify it. So that little low wall in the front with a sign on it, that actually is a hell of a strong wall. And if a truck tried to get up close to the courthouse, no way you're going to get past that wall. So that was the ram protection. And the blast protection, all of the windows have to be very, very strongly reinforced windows. And windows are super expensive, so you can't have too much of it here on the outside of the building. But the building wraps around a courtyard on the inside, which doesn't have to have any blast problem because it's protected from anything on the outside. And on the courtyard, it's floor-to-ceiling glass, and they look out to this nice little oasis of green space in the center. So we were balancing the expense of that blast resistance with lots of daylight and natural views as you get to the inside. The whole building is made of about 3,000 tons of Pecos red sandstone. This is a local stone that's very unusual. It's sort of a deep red color, very unique kind of stone. It comes immediately from that area. So if you, when you walked out on that site the first day, when there was nothing there, there were little slivers of red Pekka sandstone all over the site. It's field stone that you can just pick up. So we actually thought at first we'd use the field stone, and we looked into that, but it was terribly expensive to get people to go out and harvest the field stone and cull it and lay it. And so there were no quarries that were in operation at that time in West Texas quarrying the red Pecos sandstone. So we went back to one that was out of business and said, look, would you reopen if we could guarantee you 3,000 tons of stone for this building, would you reopen? And so the guy said, sure. So we reopened the quarry and got all the stone from a local source about 20 miles from the site. It's kind of desert landscape, and the building is meant to have a kind of rough and ready quality that fits with that desert landscape. So part of it was to say this is a working place, this is a courthouse, but that it really is a part of this community, this geography, this landscape, this place, and it's rooted here. Now, the actual cases that are in this federal courthouse are usually one of two things. They're either drug cases or they're immigration cases. And both of those are extremely volatile cases. They're ones that people get really upset about those cases. And often in this part of the country, there are large families involved in these cases. So someone is there for drug charges, but there's also a family that's involved. And they're here for immigration charges, but they were coming to the United States because they had a lot of family here already. So often the courthouse is filled not just with the people, it's almost all criminal cases, not only with the people who've been charged, but also with their families. And there are very, very high emotions that go with these cases. And in the previous facility, they had a lot of problem with violence in the courthouse. And so they had to have a lot of security, police that are there. It was a very tense environment to work in because there was always the threat of violence there. So part of what we were trying to do was make an environment that, number one, would say, you need to respect this activity. This is a dignified, powerful, important entity you're dealing with, and you need to respect it. And the old courthouse did not say that. But the new courthouse was meant to say you're dealing with an important and powerful and respectable force. So it said that from the outside. It's meant to say that from the inside. And remarkably, one of the lawyers who tries cases here all the time, she's a female lawyer, she said, all my career, I've been very frightened in the courthouse because, you know, I feel like I'm vulnerable and there are these very, very difficult, emotionally charged cases. And in the old courthouse, I didn't even realize the stress that created me because the threat was always there. She said, after 3 years working in this courthouse, we have not had a single incident. People are respectful. They just behave better because the environment sets them up to behave better. And now I realize I'm not afraid anymore. I've got a sense of security in that place, and it has made my work life so much easier because I'm just not as afraid of what's going to happen. And the whole idea was to make a place that was soothing and calming, but also had a very dignified sense of being in an important cultural institution. That rotunda on the front of the building is also a kind of public space. They don't have many public spaces in Alpine, and if they need to have a reception or an event or, you know, a new judge is coming or something like that, they've got a place where the community can get together and actually even spill out on that little terrace on the left, little shady space outside of that front rotunda. And then if an announcement needs to be made, there's a little place for someone to stand and the audience gathered below, and it has a civic sense to it. This is a part of the community. So that's a different work environment, but the building very much attuned to helping to make people's lives better who are in that environment and have to work there day to day. Okay, so that was working. Then, you know, there's the whole side of architecture that does places where we live. And, you know, obviously this is where we spend the bulk of our lives, is in our home environments. This is where we raise our families. This is where we grow up. These are hugely impactful environments. And this is actually where I live. And we did this building in 2000, and it was finished in 2004. It was one of the first, it was the first high-rise building in downtown Austin. That was a multifamily building. In 2000, there were 400 people who lived in downtown Austin. Now there are 10,000 people who live in downtown Austin. This is a huge transformation, giving that alternative of being able to live downtown. But this building was the first of those, and the developer who we were working with, he bought the piece of land, he hired us to do the project, we got all the drawings finished, and then he said, I don't think there's a market for this. I just don't think anybody wants to live in downtown, so I'm not going to build the project. And he dumped the project. A year later, he came back to us and said, well, maybe there's a market. I don't know. I'm thinking I'm going to try it. So he took a big risk and put the building up, and then it sold like hotcakes. And since then, now there are 10,000 people living in downtown Austin because people realize, yes, this is the way people really wanted to live. I didn't have any doubt about that because that's the way I wanted to live. So I moved in the building from the very beginning. I signed up for it as soon as I possibly could and told him, well, if there's bound to be other people besides just me out there. And in fact, one interesting thing was because we had no idea what the market was that might buy in downtown Austin, we built units of every different kind. There are tiny little one-bedroom apartments, and there are palatial three-bedroom units. So it's everything from, you know, tiny, tiny little spaces to very, very big places to live, and everything in between. And one great thing about it is then it attracted all kinds of people in the building. So there are 20-somethings, and there are retired people, and there are families with kids, and there's pretty much every kind of person that lives in the building. So this is actually my unit. Not all of them have the colored tiles. I sort of modified that a little bit. But basically, where there were kitchen cabinets, I just took the doors off the kitchen cabinets and gave them to Habitat for Humanity, and then made new doors that were made of these colored tiles. And you can see in the kitchen in the slide on the left, it was a way of making the kitchen not just kind of a kitchen, but making it seem like a part of the living room and dining room. And it comes all the way through the entry hall and into that part of the space. And then all of the spaces at the end of the building are floor-to-ceiling glass and get tons and tons of natural light. But in the center of the space, there isn't so much natural light. So color replaces the light. So you get the liveliness from color in the center of the building and from the natural light at the edges. So this is it's about a 2,100 square foot space. It is exactly the same size as the house I moved out of, which was a great old historic home in Pemberton, a really nice neighborhood. I thought I would really be missing, you know, the big trees and all of that, but I realized that, wow, I'm on the 11th floor. I love the big sky and the fantastic sunsets and the thunderstorms and the views, and all of that more than makes up for the trees. And also, it's just, you know, there's a spaciousness in this house that I'd never had in any of my other houses. It really is a loft, got a big double height space next to the big windows in the living room there, and does not feel like an apartment at all. Feels very bright and open and spacious. So the units were designed to be very flexible. So the unit I have, it was sold with various different options. So you could leave it just like I did, which is that there are no doors anywhere except to the bathroom and the closets. So it's just one big space. The living room, not even really bedrooms. So like when I have a party, people wander into my bedroom, and that's fine, and the bedroom opens to the study, opens to the living room, opens to, it's just one big open space. And that works great for me. But other people could actually subdivide it into a three-bedroom unit, so it had the flexibility of going several different ways. But all of that is to give people the options, and everybody has taken those options. There actually are, of the 82 units here, there are six architects that live in the building. Each of them has done their unit in a different way. I have a very good friend who lives in exactly the same unit I do, but hers looks completely different. So on that wall that has these, those are Charles Eames designed leg splints there. It's a big double height wall there. On that wall, she has a two-story bookcase because her husband is an English professor, and you know, it's just books, books, books all over the whole wall. And you can walk off the study up there onto a little balcony and get access to the second level of books, or get access to the bottom level of books from below. Fantastic, you know, modification of the unit. But the idea was that each of the units would be customizable in that way. Now, that was where I live. This is where I think probably there, maybe some of you live, but this is a building we did a couple of years ago in West Campus, 2400 Nueces. And it was for a large developer and done in conjunction with UT, and the developer both were clients. It's got, there are 600 students who live in here. There are all kinds of different units, everything from tiny little efficiencies to these are two-story townhouses over on Seton Street on the west side of the building that actually have their door right out to the street rather than through a hall or anything else. Had lots of course, parking accommodation and all that. It's a complicated, very urban building. There's a fantastic amenity level with swimming pools and a what we call a quiet courtyard, which is a more landscaped courtyard. Fantastic views to the west here to the hill country, and views to the east to the UT campus. You know, other amenity spaces for fitness, for study, for other kinds of things. And then the units themselves, although they're quite small, as student apartments tend to be, but we did make big windows, much bigger windows than anybody else in West Campus was doing. And a little balcony outside that window, and these amazing views, sometimes the downtown, sometimes the campus, sometimes to the hill country. And then left all the inside, left it rough and ready, just like in my apartment, with concrete ceilings and the exposed concrete. And then these amenity spaces. This is one of the study lounges with a view back to the UT Tower. we did a post-occupancy evaluation of that building a year after it was open. And we had two goals, actually. One was, just like Baker House, to make it an environment where people could make friends easily. And the other one was to make it an environment that actually wasn't Animal House, like some West Campus places, I hear, are kind of wild and crazy places to live. Look, how could I possibly be a faculty member and want students to be academically strong and then design Animal House? That wouldn't work. So actually, in this post-occupancy evaluation, we ask a lot of questions about, you know, what people's experience were in 2400 Nueces after living there a year compared to other places they lived. And 26% of the students said they increased their GPA while living in 2400 Nueces. 26% increased their GPA while living in 2400 Nueces. 44% of the people who lived here said that they made friends more easily in 2400 Nueces than in other living environments they had experienced while being a student at UT. There are very few freshmen in this building. They're almost all upperclassmen. So they had some comparison of other places they'd lived. And 44% said they made friends more easily in 2400 Nueces. Okay, so that's all at the multifamily level. Then this is actually just a single-family house. And this one is in Santa Fe, New Mexico. It was done for a wonderful client. And this is one of the coolest things about being an architect is, you know, just sometimes working with amazing, amazing people, and you're a partner with them in making their life better. And that was definitely true with Rick and Cynthia Torcaso. They had lived most of their life in Dallas. They had a really nice house, Turtle Creek area in Dallas. They were visiting Santa Fe one time, and somebody took them up to the top of this hill and showed them a piece of land that was for sale that had the most spectacular view just about anybody's ever seen. And they took them up there just to show them, look at this fantastic view, isn't this a cool place? And Rick and Cynthia got up there and said, we gotta live here. They were almost to retirement age, and they said, this is where we want to spend the rest of our life, right here in this inspiring, beautiful place. So when they hired us to be the architect, one of the things, they were a fantastic client who said, look, we want you to, we don't have any prescription for what we expect here. We do want that view to be an inspiration in that house. But aside from that, we don't really have any preconceptions. Now, of course, in Santa Fe, there are all kinds of restrictions you have about what you can do and how you can build. But with it staying within those, they said, you know, challenge us. Give us some ideas about how you think we should be living in our new life in Santa Fe. And so we took it on ourselves. They didn't come with an agenda about sustainability. But we said, look, Santa Fe is that kind of community. It's got some real water challenges here. It's got, you know, a climate that's challenging, really cold in the winter, pretty hot in the summer. How about if we tried to make this house just as small a carbon footprint as it could possibly be, and just as water conserving as it could possibly be, and we just try to make it as sustainable as it could be. And so they were, yes, that sounds like something we really would love to do and we'd like to get into. And now they are so into these issues. So this house actually, it has all the metrics. You can figure out exactly what energy consumption you have any time of the day, any time of the year. So it's a smart house that way. So Rick can, on his smartphone, he can pull up all of the data of exactly how much energy his house is consuming today, as compared to, say, this day last year, or this day 2 years ago. Or he can look at his energy consumption this month, or this month compared to last month, or the month before. And so all of that data is available, and he can track it all the time on his smartphone. And all that's in a display in the house as well. And he tracks it like crazy, and he's just thrilled about the fact that he, many, many, many months, he is zero net energy. He uses no energy whatsoever. There are photovoltaics in the house so that generates some energy, and there are some months where he sells energy back to the city of Santa Fe. He doesn't consume anything in the house itself. And then there's some months where he gets a little from the energy grid. But basically, it's a house that is very, very low energy consumption. And it does it in many different ways. It's built on the near the top of a hill, but not at the top, just below the brow of the hill. The hill's very steep, as you can see in the slide on the left. And so they're perching on the hill, but at the same time, they wanted a little bit of terra firma. They're gardeners, and they wanted to be able to grow flowers and herbs and things like that. So we made a little courtyard between the rock outcropping on the left and the house itself, and that's an area that these were taken very early on, but Rick just makes that a beautiful flower garden all the time. And then just to the right off of this slide, there's a green roof on the area right there, and there are wildflowers that grow on the green roof. So there's this little seam of green space between the house and the mountain on the uphill side. And then on the downhill side, it opens completely to this spectacular view. And the wall just opens up 40 feet across there. And those are sliding doors and sliding screens, so you can slide them all back or you can open it up completely, and the house just breathes from the deck into the house, back to the courtyard on the other side. And everything's got all the solar shading so that we don't get any direct heat gain through there, except in the wintertime, where you do want the warmth coming in, and it comes in where it's low in the sky there, and you get some direct heat gain in like that. But you get that beautiful view both from the terrace on the outside and then from the living room, dining room, kitchen area right there. And there you can see that connection between the courtyard, which has about a 20-foot open area that the sliding glass door can close off, and then the 40 feet on the other side to the spectacular view in the other direction. The living room is separated from the dining room, is separated from the kitchen by these pieces that are actually commissioned art pieces. They were done by Margot Sawyer on the art faculty here. We've worked with Margot, collaborated on 3 projects now, where the art and the architecture become completely integral, just like in Renaissance churches or palaces. She's a magnificent sculptor, and those are very precious art objects to the Torcasos now as well. And that's that kind of view from the dining room across the terrace and out to, you can see about 90 miles in that direction to these just layers of hills and mountains in the background. And Santa Fe is famous for these great, rain showers that move across the sky, and you can watch all the weather, and this is basically, the sunset is off to the left there, but that whole part of the sky just lights up at sunset, and it's really, really beautiful. So the house is substantially built of rammed earth walls. This is, again, high thermal mass. This is a climate with a high diurnal swing, often quite cold at night, but then very hot during the day. And so just as we talked about at Dominus Winery, where they were trying to keep the temperature stable for the wine, this is a way of us stabilizing the difference between cold at night and hot during the day. So they open up those doors at nighttime, and the cooler air comes in, and it cools down these high thermal mass walls. And then in the morning, they can shut off those sliding glass doors, and the cool walls just re-radiate that coolness all during the day. And often you don't need any air conditioning at all. Even if it gets to be 85 or 90 degrees during the day, the walls keep the temperature cooler. And then by the time it gets to be nighttime, they've exhausted all that coolness. Then you open the doors up again, and the cycle goes once again. But you're actually using the high thermal mass to air condition the house during the day. It also is made of 4 different kinds of soil in the region. There's a little town called Abiquiu, about 60, 70 miles from Santa Fe, and it has these sedimentary rocks where you can see those striations of different colors. So we got those different colors, and this is actually made by putting formwork up and then taking the soil, adding a little bit of cement to the soil, and then ramming it now with a pneumatic device. Originally, this is an ancient construction technique, and they would just ram it with poles and rods. But it compacts the soil, makes it just as hard as concrete and as dense as concrete. You take the formwork off, and you see all these layers that they put up in lifts of the soil, making the rammed earth wall. And it's actually very, very beautiful colors and texture to the wall on the inside. Here you can see the west sun over there, and the big view out this direction. Outdoor fireplace on that terrace. There are 6 different fireplaces in the house. They have, it's a fairly big piece of land, so they harvest the dead wood on the site, and they use it for fireplaces. And get the heat from that. They also have photovoltaics, which generate additional heat. They also have 2 10,000-gallon drums, one underneath the terrace and one underneath the parking area, the driveway area for the garage. Every drop of water that falls on the house is carefully maintained, and taken to one of those tanks, and then all of the irrigation on the site for their flowers and for their green roof and all of that is taken from those water detention systems. So during construction, incredible attention to not disturbing the soil. It's very vulnerable, almost desert climate there, so there aren't a lot of grasses keeping the soil stable. So you have to be very careful with any kind of runoff from the construction site. All those things were managed. The house is just as green as we could possibly make it. And I know that there was a little controversy in that lecture where we were talking about solar houses. This one has all those characteristics of a passive solar house, but not as ugly as those ones I showed you. So it's just to show that you can apply those principles and make them concurrent with principles of form, texture, color, light, shape, space, views, all those kinds of things. Okay, those are living environments. Let's take these maybe a little more tense or more difficult environments. A place where healing is what you're up to. And I've not done many healthcare environments, but I've done a couple. And I really actually quite enjoy doing hospital environments. But this was a very unique instance where we were asked to do a hospital for the Chickasaw Nation. Chickasaw Nation is, they're one of the Trail of Tears tribes that were moved from southeast United States to Oklahoma. However, they really have their act together. This is a very well-managed, well-governed tribe. And they're governed by, they have a governor called Governor Anatubby. He's been their governor for about 20 years. He's a very, very, God, I wish I could vote for this guy. He's a really enlightened man, really has the best interest of his people in mind. And so they hired us to do this healthcare facility for the Chickasaw Nation. And they have universal health care. So they use the money that they get from their casinos to supplement the money that is there from the Indian Health Service. And basically, if you have something wrong with you, you just walk into this place and you're just taken care of. No questions asked, no co-payment, no nothing. They just take care of health. They also have some real health challenges in the Chickasaw Nation. They have a lot of diabetes, they have a lot of obesity, they have a lot of alcoholism. So there's a lot of health education that goes on in this place. It's really meant to be a place to make you healthier, not just a hospital to cut on you or give you drugs. So we did this hospital, it was completed. There was a magazine that was doing an article on it. And you know, a lot of times we have our work published, but in most instances, they call up the architect and they interview you and they believe your bullshit in general and they write it down, and so you read the story and it's pretty much what you told the journalist who's writing the article. So I knew they were doing this article on the building, and they told me the name of the author and he'll be giving you a call. So he gives me a call and he talks to me about 5 minutes on the phone, and that's all he wanted to talk. And I thought, shit, what's he going to say about this thing? You know, I got a little worried. How's he going to know how great this building is if I don't tell him? But it turned out that he actually said, I'm just going to go spend some time at this place. And he made two different trips to Ada, Oklahoma, which is in the middle of nowhere, and talked to the people in the hospital, talked to the administrators, talked to the patients, and wrote the article really based on research he did on the site. So these are some quotations from the article he wrote. He said, "The Chickasaw Nation Medical Center is, in effect, a compelling affirmation of the Chickasaw Nation's commitment to universal health care and the well-being of its people. It clearly provides a level of community engagement that heretofore has been virtually unheard of in hospitals." That is really saying this is for the people it serves. It is their community place. They feel invested in it. They feel welcome there. And it becomes a kind of civic building, not just a place you go when you absolutely have to. Said Page, which is my firm, Page clearly set aside the typical paradigms of hospital design protocol and instead invested their creative passion and humanity in creating the Chickasaw Nation Medical Center. The result of their work is a community healthcare center inextricably bound to its site, region, and local culture. And damn, if I were feeding him bullshit, I could not possibly have fed him any better bullshit than that. It blew me away. So it's on a beautiful site. This is not in an urban center. It's just on Chickasaw land. And there was a little creek that ran through the property. There were big fields that were actually then went into agricultural fields, so large open spaces around. And absolutely every single hospital room has big, long views to a meadow and then beyond it, the creek. So everyone gets a view of natural environment. And these are people who are rural people. They're not accustomed to being jammed in someplace. So they have these big, expansive views to nature and to the outside. Then we also looked at their culture and the kind of patterns they have in their weavings. They have both weavings of cloth and weavings of baskets, and there are particular patterns we could observe in that. And we then abstracted those patterns and made the fenestration, the window patterns, look like the kind of compositions that you see in Chickasaw weaving patterns. In so doing, we also made every hospital room, so that's one room, that's another room, that's another room, that's another room. And although they all look different and maybe not like a bunch of soldiers lined up, which is not like what their culture is about, but to give an individuality to each room. But basically, the windows are of two types. They either are a tall single window like that, or they're a window at eye level and then a higher window like that. And this was really learning from Alvar Aalto, that notion of being a horizontal person and needing to look up at the window that way, not straight out that way. So there's always window for people who are standing vertically and eye height is like that. But there also is the window for when you're lying in the bed and you look up and see the window up higher. And those are just various combinations, the same basic kind of pattern that is put together in different ways to make that pattern that's similar to their weaving. We also used a local stone that the Chickasaws have built with for ages, and that pretty much all of their public buildings have been built for since the beginning of their culture in that part of Oklahoma. We also made the thing built around this central, what we called the town square, where there's food placed there and there's sort of check-in. Also, all their education programs are sort of centered around that area so that there's a kind of community space in the center of the building. And it opens out to a big courtyard and landscaped area and then out to these meadows beyond that. And it was really great to me the very first time I visited there after they had occupied it. We had always imagined that people would come down if they're able to walk around. You know, usually you just walk around on your floor with the little pole up there and the little drip tube and all that stuff, and you're in your funny little hospital gown. And so we thought, well, why wouldn't they be able to just go outside? Why couldn't they just go down to the lower level and there's this big space, and then you could just go out onto the terrace and you wouldn't have to feel cooped up in this hospital? And sure enough, the first time I went there, there were people, you know, going around. They didn't have their hospital gown. They got a little more modest than that. But they were going around their little pole, and if they could walk, they were outside because they were dying to be outside. If you're a rural person, being cooped up in a building like that is like being in jail. So all these doors at the end down here take you right out to that terrace and out to the outside. All over the building, it's just flooded with natural light, so that the corridors tend to not be dark spaces in the center of the building, but often they are single-loaded corridors, and you see the light on the side of it. It's a much more bright and cheerful place. So again, quotation from that article, all this attention to sunlight and natural views is more than mere aesthetic effect. It is a response to a deeply held Native American belief that nature requires our abiding respect and appreciation, and in return gives potent healing and nurturing. Dr. Judy Goforth Parker chief administrator of the Chickasaw Nation Medical Center, grounds this belief in scientific fact. Clinical studies have proven that when patients have more views, nature decreases the need for medications. So this was something we talked very much with the client about along the line. They've totally bought into this idea of trying to heal as much as we could with nature and not just with medication. So Judy Goforth, the woman he's quoting there, who was part of that client team, they moved into the building, and Judy told me about 6 months later, she said, you know, in my old building, I did everything by email. Even if I was communicating with someone 3 doors down from my office, I'd send them an email communicating the message. But she said, when we moved into the new space, I just started walking around. I didn't think about it, but it was so pleasant to walk around, and I loved being in the hospital, and so I just started walking around and going and seeing people face to face. And she said, it helped me as a manager. I got a lot more effective because I was really talking face to face with my staff. But she said the real bonus was I lost 12 pounds in the first 6 months because I wasn't sitting on my ass in my office. I was actually walking around. And she was getting healthier by the fact that the building encouraged her to move around. Okay, a final area. Maybe the very coolest things we do in my office is we do a lot of public spaces. So this is Discovery Green in Houston. 12.5-acre park in downtown Houston. It had been open parking lots. We put the parking down below the ground and then designed this very interesting park space up above. It has a performance venue. It has a branch library. It has a hamburger cafe. It has a place where you can check out all kinds of equipment for the park. It has an interactive fountain for little kids. It has a playground area. It has dog parks. It has a 5-star restaurant. It has a place for weddings and receptions and things like that. And then besides that, it just has open kind of relaxation spaces. There was this beautiful row of trees, which was it wasn't as beautiful as this. It was kind of spotty, but that all got filled in and made this beautiful green allée. This is another one of those collaborations with Margot Sawyer. That's actually how you get out of the parking garage, but it also becomes an art object in the park. There's the 5-star restaurant that has as many spaces to eat outdoors as it does indoors, with these big terraces and open spaces. All of this, those are not conditioned spaces, but for all but about 2 months out of the year, they use them for dining and for events up on the second level. It's right next to those live oak trees, and they call it the tree house. It's being right up in nature and engaging with it, and a restaurant that really feels like it's in the park. They're the checkout place for the sailboats. And then this final thing is a place here in Austin where we did over many years this much of the work on the 2nd Street District. We did the master plan in the late 1990s. We did the buildings on 1, 2, 3, 4 blocks. We master planned the City Hall but did not do that building, nor did we do the building on that block, but we're responsible for much of that district. We did the 2 buildings on either side of City Hall, the Silicon Labs buildings. We integrated existing older buildings, that signs of human presence we talked about when we were talking about humanism at a larger scale, saving that 1850 Schneider store building. The City Hall becomes the kind of landmark. It was meant to be the kind of jewel of the composition, but then more fabric buildings on either side, lower near the river, and then higher as you move back from the river. And really inventing a new kind of lifestyle in Austin where you could live and work and you could have kind of more communal activities, beautiful views, then the whole shopping district that gave an option for a public life in Austin that really hadn't existed before then and has extended beyond that now. Okay, that's it for today. See you next Tuesday. Have a great Thanksgiving.